From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The college football season is underway. Ahead on Only a Game, what the season-ending injury of Ohio State quarterback Braxton Miller means for the Buckeyes and the Big Ten Conference. Also, a look at the pressures faced by today's thoroughly televised Little League World Series competitors. Eighth-ranked Canadian Eugenie Bouchard prepares for the U.S. Open, and 74-year-old NBA referee Dick Pivetta joins us to talk about his retirement after 39 years and over 2,000 consecutive games. Also ahead, low horsepower mayhem prevails at the Demolition Derby featuring riding lawnmowers.
Someone get it on pretty fast out there. We had one guy that was popping wheelies, and I bet he was popping 3-foot wheelies with the front end would go off on it, and yeah, that's kind of entertaining.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's opening weekend for college football, a time for optimism. But for Ohio State fans, optimism turned to trepidation on Tuesday when the school announced that quarterback Braxton Miller will miss the entire season because of a shoulder injury. How important is that? Well, Miller was expected to be in the running for the Heisman Trophy. But Buckeyes head coach Urban Meyer has a plan, and it involves copying another coach, former Oregon and current Philadelphia Eagles head coach Chip Kelly. Sports Illustrated senior writer Pete Thamel wrote about Meyer's approach this week. Pete, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having me.
You wrote, the answer to replacing Miller's production could lie in the phrase heard often around Buckeye camp this summer, we want to be the Philadelphia Eagles of college football. What exactly does that mean?
When you embrace tempo, Bill, up-tempo, no-huddle offense, it really isn't just an offense. It's really like an ethos of your program. So in Meyer's trip to go see the Eagles for their training camp this year, I think helped the program turn the corner towards really embracing all things fast all the time. I went to both of their double sessions of practice on Wednesday, and they absolutely blared music. It was literally like a deafening nightclub, because the most important part of running that offense is communication and being able to do things fast in a loud environment. I thought was pretty fascinating.
In 2013, his first season with Philly, Chip Kelly guided the Eagles to a 10-6 record and a playoff berth. But with all due respect to the Eagles, isn't there a better rallying cry than trying to be a team that won its last NFL championship in the pre-Super Bowl era?
When I walked on the field at Ohio State on Wednesday, my first thought was, this feels like Eugene, Oregon in 2009 or 2010. And I really think that's ultimately what Ohio State is kind of going after, but it's just better to say we want to be the Eagles instead of we want to be the Oregon Ducks, because then you're complimenting one of your competitors on the recruiting trail who kind of play the same way you do. I really think when we look back in 25 years, football historians are going to be writing books about what Chip Kelly has done to change football.
Pete, with some trepidation, I'm going to ask you to explain why one of Urban Meyer's assistant coaches donned a fake hazmat suit on Wednesday.
I walked through their locker room in the morning, and I was with one of the behind-the-scenes staff, and he pointed to a strength coach who was wearing like a blue kind of neon, like kind of like a medical nuclear suit. And that strength coach's job is to test everyone's urine every day to make sure that they're properly hydrated. And that, again, goes along with the lines of you need to be hydrated, you need to play fast, you need to do that. So the level of detail that they were at in sort of embracing that up-tempo mindset, Bill, I thought was pretty fascinating.
With Miller out with that shoulder injury, Ohio State turns the quarterbacking duties over to a redshirt freshman named JT Barrett. Based on your research, confidence seems like it won't be a problem for Mr. Barrett. Tell us what happened when his high school coach at Wichita Falls, Ryder, challenged him to manufacture a touchdown.
On the first snap of that series, and he was a sophomore, by the way, when he did this, he went out and threw a ball, and he didn't even watch it complete. After he threw it, he ran over to his high school coach and said, how do you like that, before the receiver had even gotten in the end zone. So, you know, what they're going to get from JT Barrett, Bill, is they're going to get a guy who distributes the ball. The thing that impressed me watching Barrett kind of whiz the ball around was the caliber of players he was going to get the ball to. I agree with the notion that Miller's injury will likely remove Ohio State from playoff contention. But if they navigate that pretty manageable non-conference, they're going to contend for the Big Ten, which is really, you know, at the end of the day, all you can ask for.
Pete Thamel is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and you can link to his article, As Life Without Braxton Miller Starts, Ohio State Cranks Up the Tempo, at onlyagame.org. Pete, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you.
Canadian Eugenie Bouchard is 20 years old. She has a crush on Justin Bieber, and she enjoys snacking on baby food, but she's also the eighth best female tennis player in the world. Susan Dominus penned a profile of Bouchard for this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Susan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much for having me.
The U.S. Open begins Monday in New York. What are the expectations at the tournament for Jeannie Bouchard?
I think people don't know exactly what to expect, to be honest. You know, she made it to the finals of Wimbledon, and she's been in a couple of smaller tournaments since then and has not been nearly so successful. So there's obviously some real variability in her game. I think everybody thinks she's certainly in the running and that she has the potential to do very well, depending on how things shake down and against whom she's playing.
Bouchard's good looks and long blonde hair have caused some people to confuse her with Maria Sharapova, and at times she's followed by a group of Australians who call themselves Jeannie's Army, even though she's Canadian. So is it safe to say that Bouchard also has a lot of marketing potential?
I mean, when you think about the Grand Slams, right, three of them are English-speaking, one of them is French-speaking. She is, you know, really the only player around on the women's side who's practically a native speaker in both, and she's very well-spoken, and she's incredibly photogenic. I mean, it's quite a powerful combination, and as I say in the piece, she could sort of get by on her potential alone for a very long time because I think people don't expect women to really play at the top of their game until their mid-20s.
Bouchard's support team seems obsessed with the 1% advantage. What do they do to make sure their star is in the best possible position to win?
Well, they work on every shot, but as I wrote in the piece, I mean, there's all sorts of things that they do just to make sure that little advantage doesn't elude her. You know, everything from making sure that her trainer is the one who carries her tennis bag to the court to really thinking through how to handle the situation if a ball boy on the opponent's side is a little faster with the water or faster with the umbrella providing shade, that kind of thing. I think the idea is that when you're talking about the top 10 female players in the world, the differences among them can be somewhat marginal, so you really have to eke out every kind of advantage, even if it's just psychological and you're convincing yourself that this umbrella shade will make a difference. That, too, is an advantage.
Well, what do you do, though, if the guy with the umbrella is faster on the opponent's side? Say, excuse me, to the umpire, we need to switch umbrella boys here.
I think it's the idea is that maybe at the outset of a match, you very politely approach the ball boy and say, you know, here's what I'd really love. I'd like the ball girl. You know, I'd really love the bag of ice on my neck immediately during a changeover. Or it's, you know, very important to me that the umbrella be open right away, that kind of thing.
Hmm. Jeannie Bouchard has a twin named Beatrice who plays an important role in your story. What was it about the family dynamic that so interested you?
Well, I have fraternal twins myself, so it was fascinating to me to see that here are two young women who obviously, as their mother puts it, you know, she put them on the same schedule, they slept in the same crib for many months, they ate the same food, and yet one turned out to be an incredibly driven athlete, and the other one has a little bit more, let's say, joie de vivre, you know, and is a little bit more fun-loving. Everything is different about them from their texting style to the way they spend their time and how they think about their futures.
Susan, we don't have a lot of time, but I can't leave people hanging. Please explain why the eighth best women's tennis player in the world still eats baby food.
Only Jeannie can explain that. I think her sister does, too, actually. Who knows? I mean, when you're training to be a professional athlete, you know, you're sort of propelled into very high-pressure adult situations at a very young age, and maybe there's a part of her that wanted to cling to aspects of childhood. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she just thinks it tastes good. It's not that different from applesauce, right? You know?
Susan Dominus is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Susan, thank you very much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
Last season, the Spanish soccer team Real Murcia finished fourth in Spain's second division, just missing a chance to move up to play against Barcelona and Real Madrid in the top tier. But this week, the league announced it would drop Murcia into Spanish soccer's third division this season. Spanish soccer has been a financial mess for years, and Spain's soccer authority is finally forcing teams in the top two leagues to pay down their debts or get out. From Barcelona, Ian Mount has the story.
While the president of Spain's professional soccer organization was announcing that Real Murcia would be relegated for not meeting its financial obligations, 300 Murcia fans gathered outside league headquarters in Madrid and chanted, "This league makes us sick." League president Javier Tebas wasn't moved. Time had come to crack down on Spanish soccer's economic scofflaws.
Real Murcia wasn't allowed into the second division because it didn't comply with the economic ratios.
Of course, Murcia fans didn't feel the same way. After all, last season they'd almost made it into La Liga, Spain's top tier, and now they were going to be thrown into the netherworld of the third division. Here's Francisco Javier Carrion, a Real Murcia fanatic who writes for the fan site murciamania.com.
What did I think? Anger and impotence, mostly, but also desperation.
Still, Carrion understands.
It's unjust for the fans, but for the team as a business, it's not, because unlike other teams, it hasn't complied economically.
Murcia's crime was that it had some 35 million euros in debts, including 13 million it owed in unpaid taxes. That meant that its ratio of debt to income was higher than the new league limit of 4.5 to 1. But Real Murcia is not alone. The league put the new limits into place because Spanish soccer has been a financial disaster for years.
In 1995, the clubs in the top two divisions had 500 million euros in debt. Now they owe about 3 billion euros, including around 500 million in back taxes.
That's Placido Rodriguez, president of the International Association of Sports Economists and former president of the Sporting de Gijón soccer team. Rodriguez says that Spanish soccer is suffering from an inequity that began after TV money flooded the top league in the 1990s. The problem is that the TV pie wasn't split equally. Today, Real Madrid and Barcelona get almost 200 million euros a year, while smaller teams only get about 20 million. Desperate to avoid relegation, smaller La Liga teams took to competing with Barcelona and Real Madrid for players they couldn't afford, and then they sunk under their bloated payrolls. That's what happened to Real Murcia the last time it played in the top league, in the 2007-2008 season. Here's Carrion.
That season, the president signed players for huge salaries. The season was a disaster, and the team never figured out how to overcome the debt.
According to Rodriguez, more than half of the teams in the top two divisions have been in bankruptcy in recent years. Murcia itself went into bankruptcy in 2009. So can Spanish soccer be fixed? While Murcia fans protested outside, league president Javier Tebas talked tough about enforcing the new financial rules.
We're happy to have 100 protests like the one today, if it means we can continue to have the economic rigor the league has started and must continue.
Placido Rodriguez says that the next TV deal the Spanish league signs will be fairer and reduce the payout ratio between the biggest and smallest teams from 10 to 1 to 3 or 4 to 1. But he's not optimistic.
So the small clubs that now earn 20 million euros will earn 40 million. But what will they use it for? To buy players. So their debt won't get any smaller.
For Only a Game, this is Ian Mount in Barcelona.
Coming up on Only a Game, the formative years of college football. But first, a 13-year-old girl graces the cover of Sports Illustrated this week. Her name is Monet Davis. She's a pitcher for the Little League team from Philadelphia. Monet fever has led us to ask again a question we seem to ask every year at this time, and ESPN's Melissa Isaacson is asking it as well. Her ESPNW column this week is titled, How Much is Too Much Attention in the Little League World Series? Melissa, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
As a parent, you say that you didn't find it easy to watch your son play Fox number 4 in his first grade school play. And this week you spoke to parents of the 12 and 13-year-old stars on a much, much bigger stage, the Little League World Series. Are they made of stronger stuff than you were at that time, or do they turn into nervous wrecks in the stands?
They did. One parent said that your desire to have your child be a hero is outweighed by your desire not to have him in that position in the first place, just in case he fails. I interviewed parents of two kids in particular, Texas shortstop and the pitcher. The shortstop had the game-deciding error. And then the pitcher, who was in a crucial situation in the fifth inning and actually was crying while he was pitching, the one father said, you know what, he's just kind of a crier, and he's 12, and he just needs to learn to channel his emotions differently. And I said, you know, that's all fine when you're 13, but not when you're on ESPN, you know, and like 3 million viewers are watching in high definition.
Did those kids to whom you just referred bounce back pretty quickly from the experience of losing on national television?
The next morning when I was interviewing the parents, the kids were dancing on the field with the mascot, those two included, you know, just big smiles and dancing in front of 15,000 people. Not only did they look like they were fine, but they both came back and played in games and were fine, and the team won that very next game. So I think it's harder for us to watch sometimes.
Let's talk a little about Monet Davis, who's at the center of so much of the media attention this week. How does she seem to be handling it?
Very early on, she was very candid about how disturbed she was by all the attention. She saw the underside of celebrity really quickly with not just media requests, but, you know, it was one thing she said for little kids to be asking for autographs. But when adults ask a little girl for their autograph, it gets a little creepy. There's a little creepiness to it. You know, I suggested to her at one point, how would it be in a week from now when she goes home and people are asking for her autograph? And she looked at me like I was really kind of stupid and said, my friends aren't going to ask me for my autograph because everyone at my school knows me. When adults who are professionals and are being paid lose their privacy, you can feel for them, but you go, well, you know, they're getting paid a lot of money. But when a kid does, it's, oh, you kind of cringe a little bit. And she got that pretty early on.
There's one more thing. I can't help but wonder what your employer, ESPN, long the TV outlet for the Little League World Series, thought when you decided to submit a column suggesting that maybe they're putting too much pressure on young baseball players. I got to wonder if anybody at ESPN tried to accidentally on purpose lose your copy before it made it online.
Well, I actually was really encouraged because I think that they like to be balanced in our reporting. I mean, my concern as a writer was not to be a complete hypocrite. So I didn't want to be tisking like I wasn't a part of it. I was trying to just observe. And yeah, to ESPN's credit, I got more compliments than not. Nobody yelled at me, and I think I still have a job. So I think I'm okay.
Melissa Isaacson is a columnist for ESPN Chicago, and you can link to her column for ESPNW by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. Melissa, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
The Little League World Series wraps up this weekend in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. As we've just learned, this international event bestows celebrity on many young ballplayers, but not all Little League players have that experience. On the southern coast of China lies Hong Kong, where Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder found the state of Little League to be a bit rocky.
If you've ever played Little League baseball, then this scenario will sound familiar. Your team is down and your coach isn't happy about it. So he gathers all the players together for an impromptu pep talk.
I want to hear blue as loud as you possibly can on three. One, two, three, blue!
The coach in this case is Shanit Arkensinger. During the day, he's the assistant to the attaché of the U.S. consulate here in Hong Kong. On the weekends, however, he coaches the Tai Tam Baseball Club Gamecocks and is president of Hong Kong Little League. On this hot Saturday afternoon, Arkensinger's team is dedicating their time to mounting a much-needed comeback. The 11 and 12-year-olds dig their cleats into Toe Shek Field, a diamond littered with so many pebbles that Little League parent Janet Wynecki likens it to the surface of the moon.
You get the Toe Shek pop-ups, we call it. So a grounder's rolling at you, and suddenly it's airborne straight up in front of you. So you can take it in the eye or the cheek or something if you're not careful.
Toe Shek Field is one of a handful of diamonds in Hong Kong and is aptly named. Pronounced Thaw Set in Cantonese, it translates to many rocks. Parent Jean Bordelon, who hails from Arkansas, explains why.
Field full of boulders that they removed to make the field.
While the infield resembles a minefield, the outfield resembles, well, I'll let Wynecki and Bordelon's wife, Anne, tell you what it doesn't resemble.
It's not exactly like the outfield at Yankee Stadium.
The grass is mowed about twice a season.
Anne Spartan. Toe Shek Field boasts no dugouts, bleachers, or concession stands. In one of the world's most expensive real estate markets, its location is decidedly downmarket, in the shadow of a freeway overpass and adjacent to a noxious water pumping station, much to the dismay of player James Simon.
Whenever we play in the mornings, there's like a poop truck and everything, so we get to smell it.
Baseball may be a big hit with the Taiwanese, but the game hasn't taken off in China. The Chinese Baseball League, which formed on the mainland in 2002, suspended operations in 2012. And here, in tiny Hong Kong, rugby and soccer, leftovers from British colonial rule, still, well, rule. While rugby receives generous government subsidies, baseball relies on parents' generosity and the occasional corporate sponsorship. Most of the 450-plus kids who play Little League ball here are children of American, Japanese, and Korean expats who grew up playing the game in more baseball-friendly environments. The contrast isn't lost on Hong Kong Little League president Shannon Arkitsinger.
You know, in the United States, I had access to fields anytime I wanted. If my son wanted, we could go over to a field 15 minutes from the house, drive over there, not worry about having to pay a premium for parking, and get out on the field and hit balls and play as long as we wanted to without any issues. I miss having that access to fields just to go out there and play.
Outfielder Jason Choi tells me the limited access can't stop him from practicing. Choi lives in Taikoo Shing, one of Hong Kong's largest housing developments. There are 61 towers, nearly 13,000 units, and a lot of security guards roaming around. So Choi opts to stealthily toss a tennis ball against a wall near the estate's quiet back gate.
Like, security guards don't check it that often as the front gates, but at night you should play at the front gates because at the back gates there's lots.
And there are other ongoing issues for prospective players. Consider that after Little League ends at age 15, there are exactly two paths a Hong Kong kid with baseball ambitions can take. Leave the territory or enroll at the one international school that fields a team here. Again, Hong Kong Little League president Shannon Arkitsinger.
It's a challenge, you know, for our kids who are really good and really have these aspirations of playing in college. It's difficult because obviously they have to get game reps so that they can market themselves to college recruiters and coaches.
Final score, 8-6, Blue.
Arkitsinger's pep talk works. His team comes back and squeaks out a victory. Afterwards, I interview one of his players, 12-year-old Peter Van Wingerden. Despite all the obvious challenges to playing baseball in Hong Kong, Van Wingerden tells me he wouldn't want to play anywhere else. The teams here are divided by nationality, so every game is like an actual World Series.
Like, you have Japanese teams, Chinese teams, Korean teams, American teams, and when they play each other, it's just better compared to, like, same cultural teams playing each other.
Why is that? Why is it better?
Because it's like a new experience and you get to learn the different approaches and aspects of baseball.
And culture. Little League parent Anne Bordelon.
It's been a good experience for our son. He's a little bit more open-minded and accepting of things that are different from what he's used to.
And then, as Little Leaguer John McDermott tells me, there's the invaluable experience of having cut your teeth on baseball's most unpredictable and challenging playing surface, Toshek Field.
So when you go back to America eventually, you'll have it will be easier to field the balls and other things like that.
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Hong Kong.
Lots of the stories coming out of contemporary football are decidedly grim. Players have endured brain injuries, and they've been medicated so they could play when they shouldn't have been playing. Notre Dame is only the most recent big-time college program where suspicions of academic impropriety have surfaced. But according to Dave Revson, whose new book is titled The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation, there is precedent for these stories. Dave Revson, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks, Bill.
Among the more passionate of the game's opponents during football's early days was one Henry McCracken. He was New York University's chancellor from 1891 to 1910, and he said, quote, "Deaths and injuries are not the strongest argument against football. That cheating and brutality are profitable is the main evil." Was that assessment prompted by any particular episode?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that went on that McCracken kind of oversaw. There was a death on the field in a game that NYU was involved in, which I think really scarred him. There were a lot of people who were opposed to football in this time period that I covered, which is 1890 to 1915, but they were kind of in different camps, and there were some who believed that it was the death on the field that was the issue, and there were others, and McCracken would be one of them. President Roosevelt was another one who believed there was deception involved in the game, more so kind of the brutality at the line of scrimmage rather than people actually dying, that there was kind of an underhanded nature of the game. There were different camps of objection, and I think to a certain extent there still are today.
In football's formative years, players were regularly compensated for their efforts. What were some of the more creative ways colleges and universities did that?
You had literally people going on streetcars and offering people a wage to play for a day. You had very famous cases of players going from school to school. They were called tramp athletes. For instance, Fielding Yost, who went on to great fame as the head coach of Michigan. Yost was playing at West Virginia and went to play one game for Lafayette. They pulled a huge upset over Penn. He played that game, and a week later, he was back on campus at West Virginia playing for them. When I talk about the Michigan team in 1893, 7 of their 11 players weren't enrolled in school, weren't students at the University of Michigan. And yet people didn't find that to be strange, because part of what they were trying to figure out in this time period was, well, who should be able to represent these schools?
A tackle named Frank Hanley, who played for Notre Dame in 1896, was perhaps especially forthcoming about why he was in South Bend when he was asked, what did you take in college?
Yeah, his response was baths. you're just kind of leaving it at that, right? But I think it points to a larger issue, which is there's been this constant tug of war, as you know, between the academic side and the athletic side of a university. And I think that Hanley's example maybe elucidates it more clearly than any that I could point out.
You have to really admire his candor.
Either that, or you just have to marvel at his cluelessness.
Maybe both.
Yeah, that he really believed that that was the thrust of the question.
During the 1890s, heavyweight boxing champion John L. Sullivan witnessed a game between Yale and Harvard, and his comment on the action is, I think, worth recalling.
Yeah, he ran into Paul Daschle, who was a well-known official of the game. They were in a restroom on a train, and Daschle asked him what he thought of the game, and Sullivan lowered his voice to a whisper and said, there's murder in that game.
This is the heavyweight champion of the world.
Exactly. I mean, it points out just how violent the sport was. And I think to a lot of people, it just seemed like it was almost violence for violence's sake. And it really was in a crisis.
There are lighter episodes in the opening kickoff. Tell us, if you will, how fans in New Haven got their play-by-play for the 1893 Thanksgiving Day game between Yale and Princeton.
Basically, they'd set up a telegraph line. Results would be of each play would be conveyed. And then they had these kind of suspended puppets on wires, and they would move the puppets to indicate who had the ball and which direction they were moving in. And it's crazy, but I mean, they're sitting there in New Haven. They're 75 miles away from New York City, where Yale and Princeton were playing in front of 50,000 people. And Yale had won 37 games in a row. And when Princeton scored, ended up winning the game. And they talk about the gasps when the Princeton puppet was moved over the goal line.
A lot of your history of football's early days focuses on the playing career and the later life of one Pat O'Day, who played for Wisconsin. What made him such a fascinating character?
Relative to the day, he was covered in the same breathless way that Johnny Manziel is, including lots of discussions about a particular female companion, Dame Nellie Melba. People who watch Downton Abbey know about her, maybe the most famous female performer in the world at that time. There were issues with his academic eligibility. The university president at Wisconsin pushed him through. He was a great superstar, one of the first stars of the area that I live in and cover, the Midwest, at a time when the East absolutely dominated college football. But I just thought that O'Day spoke to kind of this broader idea, this need that we have for superstardom, and then all of these different elements which combined, I think, make college football so fascinating.
I also like the idea that some of the early stars, if they weren't paid directly with cash, they were told, well, you can have all the money that we make selling tobacco.
You think about the O'Bannon case, which was such a huge issue and still is, right, about your name, image, and likeness. I mean, there was a guy who played at Yale, James Hogan, who had a deal with the American Tobacco Company. They sold cigarettes on campus with his name attached to them, and he got a percentage of the sales in New Haven. And again, I mean, the parallels are just stunning. Everything we're going through now in this sport, the beginnings of it could be seen in this prior time period.
Dave Revson is lead studio anchor for the Big Ten Network and the author of The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation. He joined me from WBEZ in Chicago, and you can read an excerpt from his book at onlyagame.org. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, Bill, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, slow motion thrills and spills in a demolition derby featuring riding lawnmowers. This is where you shout sports, Charlie.
I'm not going to do that because I have enormous respect for America's competitive lawnmower riders.
And, of course, it's time for me to talk to Charlie Pierce about our sports news this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The college football season began this week. What are the storylines you hope to see play out this season?
Well, obviously, the Jameis Wilson situation at Florida State is still a remarkable piece of unfinished business as he defends his Heisman Trophy and national championship with this accusation still hanging over him. Where will Texas A&M go without Johnny Football, I think, is a good thing. And one of the more interesting things, I think, is ESPN's inauguration of its SEC network, which will certainly advantage that conference over its power conference rivals, and it didn't need that much advantage to start with.
The NCAA announced this week that it will appeal the O'Bannon case ruling that came down 2 weeks ago saying the NCAA had violated antitrust laws. The NCAA, of course, maintains it hasn't done that. So I guess we can count on this litigation going on for years, perhaps decades.
Yeah, not only that, but the Jeffrey Kessler lawsuit is coming down the track, too. The NCAA, unless it settles that the way it should have settled the O'Bannon case, if it goes to court on that, the NCAA will lose again, at which point that will get appealed. So, yes, I think while the new age has arrived, it's arriving very slowly.
At NFL preseason games around the country, the defensive players have been complaining that officials are throwing too many penalty flags. And, in fact, this preseason, the refs are throwing 23.6 flags per game. Last year, they only threw 12.7. Are the officials trying to make a point this summer?
The league is trying to make a point. They're trying to adapt their product to the futile task of making it safe for people to play it, and this is the end result of the most recent efforts. I think the amount of penalties will drop as the season goes along.
On Wednesday, the Vancouver Canucks settled with Steve Moore, the rookie player whose career was ended back in 2004 by a vicious on-ice punch from former Canucks player Todd Bertuzzi. The terms of the settlement were not disclosed, but the original suit asked for $38 million and might have gone as high as $68 million. Do you think this outcome will help prevent that sort of violence on the ice?
Well, I mean, I would hope that the videotape of that would help prevent more violence of that sort on the ice. I think certainly the verdict will help, but it took 10 years to get the verdict. So hockey players don't think long-term in situations like that.
Former Major League pitcher Curt Schilling revealed this week that the cancer for which he has been treated is the result of 30 years of chewing tobacco. He said he had resisted saying anything earlier because he didn't want people to feel sorry for him. I guess we can hope youngsters will pay attention now that he has spoken out.
Yeah, I hope so. And, of course, the Schillings have done wonderful work on skin cancer through Curt's wife. And, you know, maybe this will be a second front in the Schilling family war on cancer. We can only hope.
The U.S. Open begins on Monday without defending champion Rafael Nadal. He's out with a wrist injury. That means Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer are the early favorites. You want to make a pick?
Yeah, let's just have them play now and not waste 2 weeks.
At the U.S. Open, fans, of course, have been known to make the sort of noise that would get them ejected from Wimbledon. This week, numbers of players said that they would welcome noisier crowds at all of their tournaments. Do you see that happening anytime soon?
Certainly you're not going to see it at Wimbledon, but you do see rowdiness at Davis Cup matches, and everybody seems to enjoy that. Sooner or later, I think you will wind up with tennis fans behaving the way most fans do.
SI.com recently staged a poll to find out how many people would label various activities as sports. I thought that might be, I knew it would be right up your alley. Speaking of which, bowling came in at just under 70%. Do you want to guess whether chess scored lower than poker?
when a chess scored lower than poker, yeah. I said, no, there's no chance. The chess people lined up and beat the poker people.
You're absolutely right. Poker was very, very low on the list.
Chess has a wonderful lobby.
And finally, Charlie, among the candidates to provide halftime entertainment at the next Super Bowl are Coldplay, Rihanna, and Katy Perry. Each candidate has been asked about their willingness to pay for the opportunity to work that evening. Wait, what?
Just when you think the NCAA, there's a Freudian slip for you. Just when you think the NFL can't get more arrogant, they're asking people like Rihanna and Beyonce to pay to play like three numbers at halftime? Does Beyonce really need the exposure? Does Rihanna? I guess Coldplay might now at this point, maybe. This is astonishing to me. They're going to wind up getting some garage band from down the block to pay for $150.
At which point the garage band will be the greatest sensation on television because it played at the Super Bowl.
Well, that's about the only people who would gain anything by doing this.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
These are problems Buddy Holly never had.
Dick Pavetta refereed his first NBA game on December 2nd, 1975, and since then, he's never missed an assignment. On Tuesday, after 39 years on the job, Pavetta announced his retirement, and he joins me now. Dick, welcome to Only a Game.
It's my pleasure to be with you guys today.
You officiated 2,635 straight regular season games. That's three more than former Baltimore Oriole Cal Ripken Jr. played in to establish the longest streak in Major League Baseball. Were you trying to set the cross-sport record, or was there some other reason why you decided to call it a career?
Well, actually, I was not aware of the record entering into my 39th season. Someone brought to my attention, you know, you're closing in on, you know, Mr. Ripken at 26-32, I believe it is. I worked, 26-31 in Atlanta, and I mean the afternoon, or actually the morning of my game on April 2nd at Madison Square Garden, which would tie the record. I mean, I went to Mass and Communion at St. Patrick's Cathedral. I wasn't taking any chances, you know. So, but for the first time in my life, I got to Fifth Avenue and 50th Street, and I started looking both ways at traffic. And I'm saying, what's good? I said, you're getting crazy. It's only a one-way street. I said, no, it'd be just my luck to be a cab coming in the opposite direction that I don't see or something like that. So the big guy upstairs has blessed me with good health all these years, and I'm very blessed to have accomplished what I've accomplished as far as the consecutive games going.
You have refereed 27 NBA Finals games and the 1992 Olympics, and you ran a foot race against Charles Barkley during the All-Star weekend in 2007. I'm just tossing these out. Do you have a favorite moment from your career?
I think working the Olympics was very exciting because it was during the month of August, and my daughters were off from school, and my wife took off from work, and so we were able to go to Barcelona, Spain for a month. It was the first year, obviously, 92 was the dream team, mm-hmm. So it was the first time that professional NBA players were allowed to participate. So to be able to work a medal game and to be there and to experience that, that's really a highlight for me. And then, of course, the thing with Charles was just a gas. It was just unbelievable. We all thought it was a joke. I mean, I didn't, you know, it started as a joke. He was making fun of me one time during a game. You know, how could they let this old guy, you know, run up and down the court and stuff like that? And as Charles can only be that way. And, you know, Marv Albert said, you know, this guy runs 8 miles a day and he could beat you in a foot race and doing that and so on and so forth. And, you know, a couple of months later, they have this thing in Vegas and we were able to raise $100,000 for a worthy cause. And it was just a fun day. I mean, I just flew out that morning, because it's during the All-Star break, and I really wanted to be home with my family. So I flew out that morning and flew back right after, get off the plane, went to the arena, ran the race, got back in the car, went to the airport, and flew back. So that was memorable as well.
All referees, of course, blow the occasional call, or maybe not. Have you ever missed one?
Absolutely. I say that assuredly. Every night that I refereed, I strived for perfection. And every night that I refereed, I fell short of perfection. When we go back to the hotel room and we look at the tape of the game, and most people aren't even aware that After a game, we do a game report. We put down the plays that we called that we wished we hadn't called. We put down plays that we should have called that we didn't. And we're very honest and objective about ourselves and our performance. And to err is human, to forgive is divine. I don't think the losing team's fans are so quick to forgive. And they don't look at me as if I'm divine either. So, there isn't a game that I've worked that I haven't made mistakes in the game.
Finally, Dick, do you plan to continue watching the NBA as a fan, or have you had enough of pro basketball?
I don't think that I would ever stop watching the games. This 2014-15 season is just highly anticipated, you know, with the changing of teams and players. But there's got to be other things on TV that my wife will allow me to watch. I think she will determine what the TV schedule will be like. You know, maybe some reruns of Breaking Bad or something like that, or some of these programs that come on.
Dick Pivetta worked 39 years as an NBA referee. Dick, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a great pleasure.
The pleasure has been mine, and be well.
For more of my conversation with the extraordinary Dick Pivetta, visit onlyagame.org. People like to see stuff get wrecked, which is why demolition derbies are popular attractions at county fairs. A county fair in the Midwest is offering a new twist on this staple of Americana. From Minnesota, Todd Melby has the story.
If you've ever pushed a lawnmower or ridden one, you need to meet these people.
It's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, let's ride.
Welcome to the Lawnmower Demolition Derby at the Goodhue County Fair in Zimbrota, Minnesota. Folks here strap on motorcycle helmets and ride retrofitted mowers on a dirt infield in hopes of destroying their neighbors' tractors. It's been going on for 4 summers now. Will Erickson organizes the event.
Some of them get around pretty fast out there. We had one guy that was popping wheelies, and I bet he was popping 3-foot wheelies with the front end would go off on it, and yeah, that's kind of entertaining.
Before getting in the ring, drivers must remove the mower's blade. They're also required to add metal safety guards on the side and the rear of the tractor. The guards, which are usually welded into place, are supposed to protect a driver's legs and back. That's a good idea, because even with a top speed of 5 miles an hour, things happen.
We had a couple tip over a couple times, so then we stop the race and we go out there and we make sure the driver's okay and we tip it back up.
And the driver usually continues?
The driver usually continues.
A lot of drivers are like Jason Bauer. They're young do-it-yourselfers who can't afford to buy and retrofit a derby car. That costs at least $500. So they find an old mower, fix it up, pull her on a trailer to the county fair, and get ready to rumble.
I bought it for cheap and just cobbled something together. Welded some bumpers onto it, put a leg cage onto it.
Bauer has competed in other lawnmower demos, but never won anything. Nearby, a first-timer named Rachel Ecker is eyeing a machine that she and a few friends Frankensteined together.
It was my first time because I got roped into it. I told them if they put a comfortable seat on it, I'd do it, and then they did, so I got to do it.
Which begs the question, Rachel, what's your strategy?
I don't have one because I don't know what to do. That's why I'm nervous mostly. Apparently I'm supposed to hit people in the tires and not get hit in the tires.
Just then, a really loud mower rumbles by.
I'd watch out for this guy.
Yeah, he's got bras on the back.
Do you like to hit things, or like, what's your deal?
Well, yes, I like to be violent. Who doesn't? But
then I'm off to find the guy with the bras hanging from the back of his mower. Turns out, Brian McCoy is easy to spot in his machine.
It's painted bright pink for breast cancer awareness. I got my kids' names on there and a couple bras to save the second bases. Breast cancer is a big thing that I like to donate and help with the cause. Good. And pink's pretty, so go for it.
McCoy has added a noise-enhancing muffler, a pair of galvanized pipes to the hood, and a badass metal rod where the front bumper should be. The strategy, McCoy says, is simple.
Whoever hits me gets hit back harder.
Which is fine by organizer Will Erickson. Before the demo begins, Erickson huddles with the drivers in the dirt infield to remind them of a few things.
All right, and what we're going to do, the top three from each heat will advance. And once we get down to three, we'll stop it. Hit hard, have fun. Watch out for legs and stuff like that. keep your hands inside your vehicle. Last year we had someone that kept on pulling their recoil, and someone got mad at them and was reaching for that recoil. The person that had that recoil, we talked to him already, he's not going to be as obnoxious with that recoil as he was last year. No whiny attitudes.
A few minutes later, a pair of kids recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Liberty and justice for all.
America.
And then the fun begins.
And we're going.
Admission to the fair is $3, and you can see the Derby at no extra cost. So the bleachers are packed as lawnmowers begin clanging into each other. Lots of people are sipping beer and koozies, including this couple.
Never thought I'd see something like this.
And what do you mean by that?
Lawnmowers, and then them smashing together, I guess.
We want to see stuff get wrecked. Right. It wouldn't be no fun if everybody just drove off the track like nothing happened. You want to see people have to get drug off the track, right?
Red flag, red flag, red flag.
As expected, a mower gets tipped. A lanky guy in a white mower gets hit, begins to fall, then lunges out of harm's way before it hits the ground. A driver on an orange mower pops a wheelie and gets his front end stuck on the top of his opponent's machine. Several drivers, including a guy who has spray-painted his mower silver and dubbed it the Silver Bullet, suffer from popped tires, but most keep on puttering in hopes of nailing an opponent.
And we have called it!
At the end of the night, I watch a radiant Rachel Ecker, the first-time rider, ride off the track. She smiles and gives me a thumbs up.
Well, I got third place in the final round because I got stuck under a guy and they told me to quit because I already got third place, but I could have got first.
I saw that tire fall off.
Yeah, and then then the other one popped, so two tires and a ski.
So did you learn anything tonight?
Yeah, redneck innovation is the best innovation. That's all I got to say. I mean, look at us go.
As she drove off the track, a female friend jumped onto the back of Ecker's mower, hung on with one hand, and balanced a beer in the other. For Only a Game, I'm Todd Milby.
To catch all the nonstop lawnmower demolition derby action, please putter over to facebook.com/onlyagamenpr and check out Todd Milby's photos. Only a Game NPR is also our Twitter handle. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our intern is Mark Finn. And we had help this week from WBEZ in Chicago. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week is from one of the Lawnmower Demolition Derby competitors. Yeah, bring it over here, fella, and watch the hitch. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.